There are not enough financial advisors to help people in New Zealand. Whether you're trying to achieve financial freedom, get a mortgage, get insurance, New Zealand, I think, is one of the most underinsured developed countries in the world. And even then, think about the investment. Like, people look at KiwiSaver like it's this mythical beast that's all misunderstood, and they think they're actually losing money when it goes down. And there's a real problem where people can't get access to high-quality financial advice. And part of the motivation as to why I became a financial advisor, but also I no longer am one now, is because if you can have your finances in order, your life is in order, and you can make the choices to live a fulfilling life. And I thought, if I understood money, I could help people live fulfilling lives. There was something fundamentally broken with the business model. It's very hard to scale. You hire someone, they lose the business money for years until hopefully they're profitable, and then they go off to the bank or some other institution where they can get more money. So this is an in-depth look into how financial advice works in New Zealand and how Lara is trying to make a difference with the way that she approaches it. So with that, let's kick into it. What's the meaning of life, just to start with a baby question?
The meaning of life, a baby question. Oh, God. Great question. Personal belief, it's to self-actualize, it's to become everything you're capable of becoming, right? It's that Maslow hierarchy of needs. Once you've got like the baseline security foundations, you've got your food and water, your shelter, et cetera, you just continue to self-actualize. And so that's the point of life, is to become everything that you can become. It's about that experience of becoming, right?
Yeah, random. I didn't think you'd go all psychological, mate. The whole needs thing. Jeez, I can never say the word, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, how does a person come to be interested in self-actualization? Because you seem like you've got it under control when you're having mental breaks off camera once in a while. But right now, you seem like you can communicate and you've got it all going on. So, why are you interested in psychology?
I've just always been fascinated by psychology. I was actually going to study psychology, but my dad convinced me to study marketing and business and finance for his own selfish purposes. And so I ended up doing that. But I've always been fascinated by psychology, and just always from, I remember from a young age, just being, you know, motivated or fascinated by like the power of the mind and like what are we capable of, and so that's just kind of like led me down, you know, like what's, you know what, when I was 18 I went on holiday from I was a late bloomer. I only went to university like in my 30s. And so 18, I'd left school early, like in sixth grade or sixth form back then, and got a receptionist job in the city, in Auckland City. And then actually this was a job after that, a year later. I was actually working at the Burger King head office in Albany. And it was a great role, but I hated the culture. Like, it was just a really awful culture. I worked with, like, looking back now, it was almost like bullying, right? Like, I was being bullied in the workplace by the other woman there. And so it was really demoralizing, really hurtful kind of experience. And I remember I went on holiday, went down to Queenstown, had the time of my life, spent some money when I was down there, like a load of money for an 18-year-old. went back to work, and it was like the morning of going back to work, and I was just depressed. I'm not a depressed person, like it's just not in my nature, but like I was just like, I couldn't get myself out of bed, and like the thought of like going to work that day was just so like demoralizing, and like I just didn't want to do it. And that moment, like I ended up getting myself out of bed, I opened up the New Zealand Herald, and there was an article in the New Zealand Herald that said the retirement age had been lifted like from 63 to 65. And I'm like 18, right? I'm like, holy shit. Like, I've got to be doing this until I'm 65. Like, no way, man. And I was like literally in that moment, I just knew, no way. There has got to be a better way to live. Like, what I'm doing, like getting up in the morning, going to work for somebody else, working the 9 to 5, working in a job which is like literally demoralized, not the job itself, like the job itself and my boss were fantastic, but it was just the other woman that I worked with there, and I was like, there's got to be a different way to live. And like that just literally just kind of led me down this entire path of like, what is a better way to live? Because I didn't come from an affluent family, right? I was the first person in my family to end up going to university. Like at that stage I hadn't been and wasn't even thinking about it. And, you know, like my eyes were like just shut too, or you know, not shut, but like I just never experienced a different way to live. Like my parents were very middle class, you know, and yeah, I just never experienced a different way to live. And so for me, like that was the only option. Like you go to school, you get a job, you work the 9 to 5, you know, you save for a house, you buy the house, you pay off the mortgage, you have the children, you do all that. Like that's the traditional life, right? And I was like, yeah, that's all very well, but there's just got to be a better way of doing it, right? We can't be depressed and like crying every morning before going to work. And yeah, and so anyway, so getting back to like the self-actualization stuff, like that led me down the path of self-actualization. It's like, what's the reason? Like, why do we get up in the morning? Like, what's the purpose for, what's the meaning of this life? And so, and here I am today anyway.
Jeez, at 18, existential crisis.
It was, mate, it was. But I tell you, it was a good one because, yeah, it led, to, led me down many paths. And there's a few stories to be told there.
Yeah, I can sense it. I can sense the aura. I can sense this great story. It's interesting because there's a few things. Like you think the average person, they just they exist. You know, they're waiting to die. In my opinion, from an outside perspective, you see them. They're going getting drunk on Friday just so they can cope with Monday, and then crying on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they get their mortgage and they pay it off by 70, and then they live off pension.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And well, and that's directly related to like the work that I'm doing now, which is like the serendipitous kind of nature of the entire thing. From when I was 18, I had that realization, was, you know, like actually, you know, seeing people, like when I first started my future, like most people would only come to us like for retirement planning or to talk, or most people would only start thinking about their retirement like when they're turning 50, right? Because suddenly, you know, turning 65 is not that far away, and they're like, shit, we haven't done anything. And, you know, and what I saw and what my experience was before starting at my future as well was, you know, like people work their whole life. Work is their life, and then you finally get to 65, you're retired, like whether or not you've got retirement assets, because you've never had a life outside of work, like you actually don't know what you're doing in retirement. And so, you know, you see a lot of people continuing to work into retirement because they actually don't have any hobbies, or they don't have a life outside of work. Like it's just, you know, they've literally spent their entire work life working. So there's just a different way to do it, right? And it comes down into the financial planning. You know, it's literally, you know, if you can start when you're younger and you get your financial plan kind of sorted, you know, you could be retiring, like, or not necessarily retiring, but you can have a level of passive income in your 30s, 40s or 50s to allow you to actually live a different life, right? It's like, well, actually, I don't need to be working 9 to 5. I don't need to be working the entire year. You know, I've got enough passive income to take 6 months off a year. I've got enough passive income to do X, Y, Z with my time. And so it's about actually like, it's about that lifestyle by design now, right? And so that's my, you know, when linking back to when I was 18, like that's the realization that I ultimately came to. It's like, you know, if you want to create a lifestyle that you want to live, that you're passionate about, and that you wake up in the morning like, ah, what am I doing today? Today's exciting, right? You need the financial means to afford it, right? Like there's going to be a financial cost to it. And so it's about, well, how do you actually create that financial means without being reliant on work? And so it's passive income, right? And so like, how do you create passive income? And there's, you know, there's proven, tried and tested methods of creating passive income. And the earlier you start, the better. And so when I say it's serendipitous that I'm like now 20 years later, like in my future, like teaching people like this is how you create passive income. You know, this is how you do it. And so the favorite part of my job and all of our advisors now is like, you know, talking about clients' goals and like, what do you want to achieve? What are we doing here? You know, and especially talking to the younger clients as well. It's like, right, you may not be earning a huge amount of money because you're young, you're inexperienced, you're still kind of cutting your teeth, but you know, you've got an opportunity here, right? And the earlier you start, the better. And helping them realize that is, you know, it's really rewarding, really satisfying. It's it's cool.
You said a few things that triggered me. When you say passive income, I'm always like, ah, what do you mean? Like people say, oh, I'm going to own a property, it's passive. And then meanwhile, you're fucking, you know, spending, you know, every week trying to fix the house, replace tenants.
Absolutely.
Do something like that. What do you mean by passive income? What's your...
Yeah, well, look, Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, you've got passive income. True passive income is you've got money which is, you know, you're receiving money which you're not actually having to exert any effort for, right? Like, you've got money coming in from investments that you don't have to do anything for. So yeah, like some people like use property, like assuming you've brought an investment property, it's paid off, and now you're just getting the rental income. Okay, great. But the reality of it is, yeah, you're having to maintain that property, you're having to either act as a landlord yourself or deal with the property managers. And so there's still a certain level of input required to maintain that. So, you know, property in itself isn't a definition of like true passive income. Like, it can be a form of passive income, but it's not, you know, a true form. And if you want to be a landlord and like that's how you want to like spend your time, like, go for it, like, awesome. But if you don't, and if you don't like fancy, you know, doing maintenance on your properties or having to spend money to maintain properties, then, you know, there's different vehicles to create passive income.
Yeah, so what are they? What is this mysterious passive income? Because any income I generate is very active.
Oh, it's hardly mysterious. Like, there's five asset classes, right? You know, cash, fixed interest, commodities, property, and shares, right? And so if you're talking about passive income, you're primarily talking about shares, managed funds, shares, right? Because you're investing, and most probably managed funds in your retirement. Like, if you've got a level of investment assets and you're investing for income, right, we're no longer in that wealth creation phase, you're investing for income, then, you know, arguably, and I say arguably because I'm sure somebody would disagree with me, the best place for you to be invested is in, you know, an appropriate suitable managed fund where you're diversified, but you can set it up in such a way that you're getting a regular income and you're just living off the returns from your managed fund. So you're not eating the capital, you're just living off the returns, right? And so that's the ideal situation where you want to get people to, is like, you know, you've got that wealth creation phase where you're, you know, like, yeah, you have to work to like earn money so you can invest in your investments and get to a certain level. But once you're at that certain level, then you can invest those assets to create income.
Yeah, cool. I mean, obviously, I used to be a financial planner, so
yeah,
I sort of
know all
I
this, Ryan.
Yeah, but people listening to it haven't, and I haven't talked about finance in a long time. But I also was challenging you. I was just curious if you were going to say, you know, something out of pocket.
Right.
But you didn't, so it's good. Well, why do you think investment has such a bad name? Because, you know, there's we'll call it symmetries of people that have had failed investment opportunities. You know, they're speculating on the share market. They're bragging at the golf club how much money they made, and then they lost it all.
Yeah.
How come this managed fund, why doesn't everyone know about it, and why isn't everyone losing money when they use it?
Hey, look, great question. I think a lot of that will come down to diversification, right? Like, if you're investing in specific shares, there's inherent risk, and you're literally putting all your eggs in one basket, right? You're investing in one company or just a handful of companies. And so it really comes down to like the power of those companies. But when you're investing in managed funds, you're getting that dilution. You're getting the diversification. You know, in a good managed fund, you know, it's diversified across, you know, some of them are like 10,000 different, you know, shares. So essentially, by investing in one managed fund, you're investing in thousands of different companies all around the world. You know, and so there's an element of protection there. You know, why does it have what's the negative of it? Well, you're paying somebody else to manage your investments, and a lot of people don't like that. You know, a lot of people think like, oh, I can do it myself. And it's like, okay, well, you go off and research 10,000 different companies then, manage that, and, you know, you make your own investment decisions. Like, you go for it. But if you're trying to manage a full-time life and, you know, a full-time job and a family and, you know, sports and hobbies in the meantime, and then I hope you've got a good team around you, because you can't do that by yourself, right? So the reason why you're paying to be in a managed fund is because you're paying for the skills and the expertise of the people who are making the decisions in that fund, right? So it just comes down, like, do you want to do it to yourself? Like, and if you want to do it by yourself, then actually you should be in financial services and you should be making a career out of it, right? Because you're that passionate about it and want to do it. But if you're not financially minded, you don't have the inclination to put that much time and effort into it, then, you know, pay somebody else. Like, there's professionals out there that do this for a living. Like, pay them to do it.
It's fascinating to be on the other side of this and seeing how people explain it.
Right. How would you explain it?
Similar. I use a boat analogy. So I see a managed fund kind of like a, you know, a cruiser. So, you know, it's stable, it's secure, it'll get you where you want to go. But there's going to be rough waves. There's going to be times where it's volatile. It goes ups and downs. But provided you don't jump off, you're not going to lose money. And I think that's the hardest thing with people that are experiencing that with a KiwiSaver. People don't really understand KiwiSaver. It's down. It's confusing. Oh, I've lost all this money. And they start freaking out. How do you talk people off the cliff? And do you preempt it? When you do a consultation with someone, you're like, hey, the money's going to tank for 30% for a few years. Are you ready?
Yeah, 100%. I always had those I told you so conversations at the beginning. And I said, at some stage, I'm going to reference back to this conversation we're having today and say, I told you so. And the conversation that we're having today is that it's not going to be smooth sailing, right? There's going to be ups, there's going to be downs. This is volatility. That's the nature of it. But we are in this for the long haul. And the money that you're investing, right, is money that you don't need in, like, in the immediate future, in the next 10 years. This is all money that you're investing for your retirement. So we are sticking at it until retirement, right? And there's going to be bad days, and there's going to be good days, and sometimes you're going to love me, and sometimes you're going to hate me, but I'm going to be there. We're going to be there through, like, the thick and thin. We're going to be having awkward conversations, and I'm going to remember, I'm going to, like, literally come back to this conversation and say, I told you, we had this conversation, there's going to be bad days. These are the bad days, but we're sticking at it. As long as the goals are still the same, and as long as the situation, like the circumstances are still the same, like they haven't lost their jobs, or like their ill health, or like something major in their life hasn't changed, then we just carry on. It's just volatility, mate. It's all right. You know, we'll get through this. And but the other thing with KiwiSaver, the great thing about KiwiSaver is, like, they can't withdraw their money, right? They can't say, ah, oh, it's a 30% downturn, I'm going to withdraw all my money. It's like, oh, you actually, you can't, right? It's in there. What they can do, though, is they can change from, like, an aggressive fund to a conservative fund, right? Or vice versa, or whatever. And so there's still, like, an element of coaching of, you know, don't change anything. Like, you're good. You're in an appropriate fund. Get your hands to stop checking your emails for a few days. Stop listening to the news for a few weeks. It's all doom and gloom, but we'll get through it. It's going to be fine, right? So, yeah, those conversations are important with clients.
It's tricky. Yeah. It's like it's very hard to conceptualize what KiwiSaver is. I always say to people, I'm like, if your house went down in value from 1 million to half a million, would you rush out to sell it?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
But it's like, the challenge is, so people, and it's a challenge as an advisor too. So, like, someone comes in, they've got a KiwiSaver provider, they're pretty similar. You know, some are bad, most are pretty good. There's not much deviation. They seem to track the market in a pretty similar way, but they call themselves special. And then they come in and they're like, hey, Ryan, my returns, you know, I've got returns from this product provider, but I've heard there's better ones over there. I'm going to switch. So they sell the underlying assets. So they sell the house. And then they go and buy another one in either the same market, or they're crystallizing a loss and it's slightly different. How do you navigate the one, having a client knowing that as an advisor their life's probably going to be better, but then also they have a product that's fine, so you don't need to change it?
Yeah, like, we had that conversation around the problem with chasing returns, right? If you're always going to try and, like, chase returns, then you're inherently going to lock in some losses, or it's just, you know, there's going to be costs involved with changing every time, like, a new report comes out that shows a different, you know, provider at the top. So it's a flawed strategy. Like, that's not, you don't want to be chasing returns. Like, and so it's just about that, the underlying investing principles, right? They've got to be sound. Is it a sound provider? Do they have a great reputation? Do they have consistently, like, over the long term, consistently good returns, right? Like, you don't want, like, somebody who was, like, number one last year, but we happen to be in a market downturn, and they're kind of, like, geared up to, like, benefit from market downturn. So they had, like, an outlier year, but then the rest of the years are, like, they're down at the bottom of the field. Like, that's, you know, are they consistently, like, within that, like, top five kind of like ideally top three. And then there are like standout ones, which are consistently like top three, right? Like over like the 10-year returns. So it's just about coaching them on that. You know, you want somebody with like with the sound, the foundational kind of the foundations in place to consistently give you good performance. You know, it's not about chasing returns. Like sometimes they're not going to be at the top. Sometimes they're going to be a little bit lower. But other years they are going to be at the top, right? And so if we track it and like, hey, actually they've suddenly gone from being like consistently like 1, 2, or 3. Now they're around like 7, 8, 9, 10. And hey, now they're even further down the field. Then it's like, okay, well now it needs to be reviewed. Like something's changed, right? Something's changed and it needs to be reviewed. But like you don't do that like every time a new report comes out. It's like, right, we're changing everybody, we're off to the best performer for the last quarter. Like you just don't do that, right?
Well, yeah, most don't.
Hopefully you don't do that.
No, I don't, but it's just I've talked to a lot of advisors now, and I'm just some like usually when it's the insurance agent that was dabbling in KiwiSaver. So one guy who's telling me how he had a provider, I think it was before COVID, everything was down something like 30%, maybe 20%, let's say. And then he rushed out all his clients, hey, you got to sell it. Sell, so you can be in conservative so that you're not going to, you know, experience that loss. Just wrecked everyone's life savings. And that's a challenge. It's like everyone's like, oh, you need to have financial literacy in school. People don't know what they're doing. But it's boring. How do you explain it? How do you make it interesting? Why do people want to know? And the problem is it's not actually logical. It's emotional. It's nothing to do with, like, you could learn finance, in my opinion, in 2 weeks. Like, you could just say, managed fund is this. It's got to be diversified like this.
Yeah, it's not rocket science, right? Like, it's not rocket science. It's pretty, like, it's one of those things, like, once you know. But if you don't know, then it's a world of mystery, right? But this is what I actually found really fascinating was I did my MBA, majored marketing, I had that dual focus, marketing and finance. But even like, you know, after graduating, and it was only until I started in my future that I actually understood financial planning and how to create wealth. Like all the subjects that I took as part of my finance major was like doing like stock, portfolio stock analysis, right? And you know, economics and macroeconomics and international, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like in accounting for management and like all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, well, that's all very good, but it doesn't tell me how, like, as an ordinary Kiwi, how to create wealth. Like, how do I be smart with my money and create wealth? It didn't touch on any of that, right? And so even after I left and got my MBA, like, I was still, like, clueless on, like, the personal financial front, right? Like, and at that stage, I was racking up debt. I was almost 100 grand in debt. I was, you know, like I was taking on loans, like personal loans for cars. I was like getting loans for XYZ. Like I was just spending more money than I'm making. And it was like literally just because I didn't have that that personal financial literacy, which is strange, right? And it wasn't until I started my future where I was like, oh yeah, of course, this makes sense. And it's just really simple things, right? It's like, don't spend more money than you're making. Save. What do you do with those savings? What are your options? Okay. Like, how do you do a wealth creation strategy? Like, and you know, actually like doing the forecasting and doing the planning and actually getting involved in like in the investment side of things. Then I was like, God, this makes so much sense. And especially like around mortgages as well. Like you go to a bank and you just get given like a standard 30-year P&I mortgage. Like that's just what would happen. Like it's not even questioned, right? Like if you're an ordinary person, like you're not in the finance world, you're not a mortgage broker, you go to a bank, you get a loan, they're not even going to ask you like what term you want it over, right? Like they're just going to say, well, here's your loan, right? And it's a P&I loan, it's over 30 years, and here are your repayments. You're like, yeah, I can afford those repayments, sign the dotted line and off you go. Like, and that's just it, right? And it wasn't until I started my future where I was just like, God, you can actually structure your lending in such a way and you can like manage your cash flow in such a way that you can literally get that loan paid off in 15 years. And in most cases, you're saving yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all of those savings you could then utilize for your investment strategy. So it was just like my mind was just blown, right, when I started. And it was just like a real revelation. And it just came down, it's like, God, they don't teach this at school. Like, they literally do not teach this at school. And it's not rocket science, but saying that, you know, if you're not financially minded and if you don't have the inclination or the motivation, like I mentioned before, to do it, then, you know, that's why you have a financial advisor. Like, that's why you should have a financial advisor. It's just like having, you know, having a doctor, right? You know, if you've, you know, a family doctor, something, you know, something happens and we hurt ourselves, we go to the doctor. You know, if, you know, it should be the same concept. If you're earning and you're like, you've got a job, you're earning money, you should have a financial advisor helping you, regardless of whether you've got a home or a mortgage or not. You know, that's a financial advisor can help you with your long-term wealth creation.
What do you actually think the value of a financial advisor is and where you think it's going? Because I used to struggle with that a lot, being like, you know, I'm not necessarily getting them more returns, but they end up having more returns because they don't jump off the ship. You know, they stick to the plan and they hit something appropriate for the time horizon. And then I also think, well, people call me, oh, my husband's got dementia, they're going into care, what do I do? I was like, well, we planned for this, it's probably going to cost $1,000 or $1,500 a week. So what do you actually think an advisor, the value of it they are now and where they're going? Are they going to be Tony Robbins in the future? What do you think?
Yeah, great question. I think the first thing is that there's different types of advisors, right? Like with this new legislation which has come in the last 24 months, we're all called registered financial advisors. We're all called financial advisors, but there's no differentiation between an insurance advisor, a mortgage advisor, or somebody that helps you just with your, like, your investment assets, like a managed fund kind of person. So there's no differentiation between any of those. So for starters, they're like, that's confusing. Like if you ask somebody, oh, do you have a financial advisor? They'll be like, yeah, somebody helped me with my mortgage 2 years ago. And it's like, okay, that's a financial advisor, but, you know, there's other financial advisors as well. And I think that's where, like, My Future's like quite unique, is that we actually do the long-term financial advising, the long-term financial planning, but we get involved in the mortgages. We don't do mortgages ourselves, like we use third parties like to transact the mortgages, but we make the recommendations on the mortgage structures, help them to pay it off, all that kind of jazz. And then we also do, on the investment side, we do KiwiSaver managed funds, but we also do property as well, right? And so we have our real estate license, well, we're licensed by the REA, the Real Estate Authority in New Zealand. So we can actually get our hands dirty. We don't just say, oh yeah, like this is what your financial plan looks like if you plug in a property or two, but it's like, okay, yeah, if property's suitable for you, we can actually go out there, find you suitable properties, make recommendations, and so we can do that entire thing. Like, and so we're quite, well, it's almost like a one-stop shop, right? Like, you come to us, we can do your entire financial planning thing. So to come back to your question, like, where do you see us in the future, like, in whole, what I'd like to see is there to be people to understand the difference between different advisors, and for it to be normal to have an advisor, like a long-term wealth creation, like a personal financial advisor, like for it to be normal. You know, like, I want to get to a stage where, you know, you're out with your mates, you're having dinner, and it's like, oh, you know, who are you using for your financial advisor? And it's like, oh, it's Lara at My Future. And it's like, oh, yeah, cool, right? And so, like, to that stage where it's normal, and if you are working and you are earning money and, you know, you don't have a financial advisor, it's kind of like, oh, mate, what are you doing? Like, you know, you need to speak to a professional, somebody who's actually got the skills and expertise and resources to be able to help them. Like I said, unless they're a DIY person and they really want to do it themselves, in which case they should actually be operating in the industry, right? They should be doing it as a job.
It's a tricky model. Like, you think about, I think of it kind of like a branding perspective, and Alex Hormozi calls a brand as like training behavior at scale. So you're teaching people how to react when they see your face or this logo.
Love that. Great.
And you think about the financial advisor brand. So people are used to not paying for advice because all the insurance brokers, mortgage brokers make a commission.
Yeah.
And then prior to that, it was share brokers that would, you know, wear buying and selling hats. So they'll say, buy this, and then on next phone call, say, sell it.
Yeah.
And then people losing money.
Yeah.
So how do you think we could rebrand and make a differentiation or a positive association to financial advisors where they see them as a doctor? Like, what would be, if you could?
Well, look,
how would you do it?
That's, I mentioned just before you started recording, we just hired our a branding and marketing coordinator. So for us personally at My Future, like that's part of our next 24-month objective, is to really just go out there, go large, and start normalising having a financial advisor. So we literally, we just got some like initial kind of brand videos, which we got recorded yesterday actually. And so they'll be released like in the next few weeks, just kind of like testing the market to like see what the feedback and the response was, like have we got the messaging right, all that kind of stuff. And so for us personally, it's just a communication piece, right? It's about educating consumers and just educating the public, like, hey, everybody should have a financial advisor, a personal financial advisor, right? There's no point having a mortgage broker if, you know, you've just left school and you don't have even have a deposit, right? Like, you just don't have a mortgage broker. Like, that's just silly, right? But everybody should have a personal financial advisor. So if you have just left school and you are earning money now, go do a discovery session with somebody from My Future. We can help like just map it out, like what are your goals, what are you wanting to achieve, how much money do you have to put towards this, okay, well this is kind of what it looks like for you, right? And just get them like motivated and inspired about what their wealth creation potential is. You know, people who are older, people who do have a mortgage, even people like nearing retirement, it's just like, you know, I personally believe everybody could benefit from speaking with or having a personal financial advisor. And so it's just about communicating that and having the platform to communicate it. So I think, you know, obviously being on your podcast today is a platform to communicate that. Like, everybody should have a financial advisor. It's just what we should do. And I'd love New Zealand to be known, like, you know how like we think of Sweden and, you know, like these connotations that we have with Sweden, like it's got a really high kind of really high quality of like living in like the Swedish kind of countries and all the countries. Like, I want people to like look at New Zealand and be like, hey, yeah, they're really cool, like everybody has a financial advisor there, right? And I want it like to be like the thing that we're known for, you know, the people travel to New Zealand and they're here for a few months and they leave and it's like, oh, New Zealand's great, everybody's got a financial advisor, right? It's just like part of the culture.
Okay, all right. I mean, it's not improbable.
It's time and effort, man. Like everything's possible. You just got you need the plan, the time and the resources to make it happen.
I think the biggest barrier is staff in the business model.
100%. Yeah.
Because I'd be interested to talk to you about that as well. Because I left to be an advisor because I wanted to learn marketing. Mm. So I just wanted to reach more people. So I was trying to work out who to market for, and then I thought of advisors because I understand them. And I was a financial planner. I thought I'd work with them. But the model as a financial planner is incredibly hard. It's like, You have a small upfront cost you charge sometimes to do some plan, mm. and then you have a small retainer, and it's quite hard to identify people that are debt free and can invest a large mm-hmm. enough sum of
and
money
to
support
you.
And it's
so competitive as well,
right? Yeah, very competitive. And then so that means when you hire someone, depending if you don't have a good acquisition structure, mm. that they're probably costing your business money mm. for a few years. Mm. Before it's profitable, so mm. how do you scale it?
Yeah.
So what has been your strategy to fix those problems?
Yeah, look, great question. This is our 8th year in business, and up until now, we've been entirely, our advisors, our support staff fix salaries, but advisors commission-based, right? Mm. And that way, you know, but to go along with that, it's flexible, right? Like if you're not working, you're not earning. And so we always have really self-motivated advisors. Like people are like, no, I see the potential, I want to do this. And you can just allow them and give them the resources to actually go out there and just do their job. But it's all commission-based. And so if they're not earning, then it's not costing the business, right? And so that was successful to an extent. But obviously to support that, you need the leads, you need the customer base, right? Because the downside of that, like I've spent years training some amazing advisors, I'd say that they were better than me, right? Like they just picked it up in a heartbeat. They had a natural, they were just a natural, great with people. They were just attention to detail. Spent 2 years training them, like getting them fully up to speed. And most of that 2 years is because, you know, it is commission based, and so they have to keep their foot in the door with something else so they can earn an income while they're growing their career, right, their advisor career. But then you know, at the end of that, just, you know, the downfall and losing them was we didn't have enough customer base, we didn't have enough leads to support them, right? And so they couldn't earn their full income potential because we just didn't have like the customer base for it because we weren't investing enough in our marketing, etc. And so, you know, there's pros and cons to both. And so now what we've done like in the last kind of 12 months is that we are transitioning to like a hybrid model. Like you've got a retainer, but you're also on commission, right? And so the retainer allows you just focus on it full time. You can get up to speed more quickly. It just gives you that base. You can commit to it. And you know, but you still got the commission model for advisors, so they are like personally incentivized, like financially, to, you know, to go out there and you know, do business and speak with clients and stuff.
What's your acquisition strategies? Because a lot of people, they use intermediaries, so family lawyers, accountants.
Mm.
Some dabble online,
yeah,
but most of their business is referral. And if you've got no reputation and you're a new advisor,
yeah.
Off you go. Go find someone. Yeah. It's a little, yeah.
Yeah. Historically, it's been all three of those. So it's been referrals, it's been online marketing, and it's been like that professional advisor network. You know, last 24 months, we've invested like quite heavily in our SEO stuff, which has been great. Digital marketing, we've just been like pretty consistent on for like the last 4 years. It used, like, digital marketing when we first launched it, it was just a game changer. But, like, it's over the years, it's like this return on investment has diminished, but it still provides, like, a sustainable and, you know, a source of, like, business. Yeah, but what we're wanting to do, like, this next 24 months is just kind of, like, shake things up a little bit with that branding strategy. So, like, just really coming out, like, we really want to normalise having a financial advisor around New Zealand. And we want to become, not, like, New Zealand's most trusted advisors as well, like, in that space. And so that's what our focus is going to be on. And also, like, channel partnerships as well, you know, like, developing those relationships with accountants, and, you know, mortgage brokers, real estate agents, you know, all these kind of people to, you know, it's like you're literally working with our ideal kind of target market, like our ideal client base, refer them on to us. Like, and so, like, what's the, you know, so, like, setting up a referral partnership arrangement with those kind of channels.
Because I think fundamentally the clients aren't valuable enough, which sounds... you know, demeaning, but in the sense that we call it client-funded acquisition. So I finally decided just to go with insurance brokers because mortgage brokers take too long for the sales cycle, and they're investing money into Facebook and not getting a return, and then, you know, they'll drop off.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance brokers get a commission up front very quickly, which funds the next lot of spending on advertising. Have you ever thought of ways to make the clients more valuable, whether it's partnerships, commissions, or adding another thing that you sell?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we operate a little bit differently to most financial services people because we are doing, you know, mortgages indirectly via like our third parties. We do insurance in-house, we do KiwiSaver in-house, we do managed funds, right? And so we do all of that, but we still take an onboarding fee when we're onboarding and taking on a client, and we do property investments as well. And the reason why we take that onboarding fee is that's the client engaging us as their financial advisors and engaging us to implement and manage the long-term wealth creation strategy. And that's us taking ownership of their financial plan, right? And that's us saying, hey, we said you are going to be here in year five, and this is where you're going to be, like, literally. And we're banking the house on it, right? And we actually have a guarantee, like a money back guarantee with that onboarding fee. We say, like, if you're not here by year five, then we'll refund that implementation fee. If you're not here by year 10, we're going to refund that implementation fee. And so one's linked to their mortgage, like if they're not down to a certain, like their mortgage isn't where we said it's going to be by year five, and then also, and year 10's their net position, so where is their wealth at year 10? Like, if you're not here, like, you've done everything we've told you to do, Like, we made a plan for you. We told you how it's all going to work out. You've agreed to this. You've paid us to manage the implementation. You've engaged us to become your financial advisor. You're doing everything you're telling us to do. But if you're not hitting these milestones, then we'll refund that implementation fee, right? Like, because, yeah, that's just how we operate. And so that's our business model. So we're our client, yeah, so we're, you know, we're really engaged with our clients. Like, when we take on a client, like, it's, you know, it's us making that decision to take on that client because it's somebody that we want to work with, because it is a long, we just simply don't do transactional relationships. It's literally every single client that we have is with the view of we are going to be their advisor for 10 or 20 years, if not more. Like, we actually want to do their entire wealth creation strategy, and then once they're gearing up for retirement, we're going to help them liquidate all of their investment assets and get them ready for retirement. And we want to be with them in the retirement, and then we want to work with their children, right? Like, so we want to be that personal financial advisor for, like, the entire family unit, right? Like, these are just our my future is just our financial advisors, right? Like, that's where we want to go to. And so it is about those long-term relationships. And the cool thing about that is that we've got some really cool clients. We've got some really cool relationships with our clients. So they're not just clients. You know, these are, you know, I don't want to, like, friends. We're very friendly with our clients, you know. I don't want to abuse the word friends, because my clients will be like, oh, okay, you're my advisor. But, you know, we're very, like, we do have, like, a strong relationship friendly with our clients. You know, to the extent, you know, like, when I had my first daughter, I had clients, you know, sending me presents, like, to say, like, congratulations. Like, at Christmas time, we get invited to, like, you know, their family Christmas events. Like, you know, when they have their birthday parties, we get invited. Like, we get, you know, like, we just get invited to their personal things. So, like, that's, for us, is, like, validation that we're doing our job properly. We're actually building these relationships with our clients. And, you know, we're doing a good thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's, like, once you get through, let's say, the first 6 years of being an advisor, it's incredible because it's an amazing lifestyle, and you're, most of the time, the conversations are positive. I don't think you really talk about money that much. Sometimes when it's down, you give them consoling, but you're mostly talking about everything else. What do you find is the challenge? Because I haven't seen someone successfully pull it off. Yeah. You know, the model is, it caps. So what do you think is the biggest bottleneck? Is it the delivery of the advice? You know, like...
What do you mean you've never seen somebody successfully pull it off? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah, I see it more as a job than a business. So they have incredible incomes and incredible lives.
Yeah.
But they don't have a business. They don't have, let's say, 20 advisors that blah, blah, blah. Unless they actually manage it themselves and they're the investment. Yeah. You know, like the big providers and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it takes time to service your clients, right? You get an email from a client, you know, it's a 20-page email. It takes time to read that, figure out what they're actually asking you, you know, replying to them or picking up the call and talking to them. So it takes time, or, you know, that's the informal stuff, like the actual providing the official recommendations and, like, doing, like, you know, the six-step process, like getting to know your client, you know, documenting your understanding of them, you know, doing providing all your disclosures, like going through all the compliance stuff, like just the journey of financial advising and providing that job, or doing that job, takes time. And so, you know, there's a limit to how much you can actually do. And so I think the key, like you said, that bottleneck is having the systems and processes in place, like the technology in place to allow you to do your job. Well, and not just the systems and processes, but actually the support team as well, to allow you to actually do your job really efficiently. And so as an advisor, you can just spend, you know, 90 to 100% of your time, like, actually just doing the client face-to-face stuff, like just doing, like, talking through the recommendations with them, like finding out, like, what's the update on your situation, and then having a team behind you to actually, like, execute on all the groundwork. So I think that's the key to really, like, scaling an advisor role, is to have the infrastructure. Like, yeah,
what do you think's, like, you go? Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, yeah, you can operate it like as a sole. Well, actually, you can't operate as a sole advisor under this new regime, can you? It's like you need to belong to a body. So, Yeah, so that's irrelevant. You used to be able to operate as a sole advisor and just do it all yourself, but then you're only taking on a few clients a year, right? Because you're limited by how much you can do.